from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. Coming up this hour, two stories on the cutting edge of health. First, an ethical dilemma. If a married couple preserves its embryos for the future, then divorces, who has the final say over what to do with the embryos? That drama is playing out right now in a San Francisco courtroom. We'll explore the case in our first half hour. Then we'll meet the directors of a new long-term medical study investigating the health issues affecting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. A groundbreaking LGBT health study and a custody battle over embryos. It's all ahead. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Mina Kim. Divorce is complicated, but few divorces are as complicated as the one at the center of a case in San Francisco. The couple, two Harvard-educated professionals, one infertile after surviving cancer. The assets in question, five embryos, cryogenically preserved before her cancer treatments began. Mimi Lee wants to keep the embryos and someday have children. Her ex-husband, Stephen Findlay, wants them destroyed. If this sounds like an emotional but rare case, perhaps it is, but not for long. Technology is moving fast, and these kinds of disputes could get more common as more couples seek new ways of family planning. Let's discuss the case in this half hour of Forum. Joining me here in the studio is Professor David Magnus from the Stanford University School of Medicine. He is the director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. David Magnus, good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us by phone is Professor Judith Darr of the Whittier Law School in Costa Mesa. She also teaches at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine with a focus on bioethics. Judith Darr, welcome to Forum.
Hello, Joshua. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Judith, let me start with you. What is the central issue in this case? Is there one main question that the court is trying to work out?
In this case, the court's going to be trying to determine whether the agreement that the party signed at the fertility clinic prior to undergoing IVF will govern the disposition of these frozen embryos. So at its core, it's really a question about the preconception agreement and its enforceability.
This is the document that UCSF had the couple sign as they were preparing to go through this whole process, right? Explaining what the responsibilities are, what could happen, what the risks are, that kind of thing.
That's right. And virtually every fertility clinic in the United States will have its patients sign such agreements prior to undergoing treatment.
David Magnus, why does Stephen Findlay, the ex-husband, why does he argue that these embryos should be destroyed?
Well, he obviously doesn't want to have a child with his now ex-wife. That creates all kinds of potential custody issues, child support issues, and even just emotional and psychological issues with having a child. For the most part, though not completely consistently, courts have ruled that a potential parent's right not to be a parent, that a party's right not to be a parent, has a slightly greater weight than someone's right to have a child. So he's got a fairly strong claim that that he shouldn't be forced into a parenthood against his will.
I know we only have this topic for the half hour, so we should probably open the phones relatively soon. We are discussing this emotional case of a divorced San Francisco couple arguing over their embryos with Stanford professor David Magnus and Whittier Law School professor Judith Darr. We'd love to hear from you, too. What do you think should happen in this case? As you hear more about it, maybe you've got some questions and thoughts of your own. So please do join the conversation. Call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Judith, these cases are not as rare as they perhaps used to be. There is a very high-profile case involving Sofia Vergara, the actress from the comedy Modern Family, in a dispute with her ex. How are courts dealing with these cases in general? Do they tend to go one way or the other, or are they all right now just a little bit different from each other?
You're so right to say that this is a budding area in the law. Since 1992, courts have been deciding these disputes, and the legal landscape is incredibly scattered. Courts have decided these in any number of ways, including upholding the agreement, failing to uphold the agreement because it violates public policy, requiring that the parties have contemporaneous consent, or even balancing the interests of the parties. And I wanted to address one thing that Professor Magnus said. It is true that I would have told you 2 years ago that the trend was always in favor of procreation avoidance. The person, typically the male, who wanted to avoid becoming a parent was often the winner in the lawsuit. But there are a couple of recent cases that have facts very similar to this case, where the woman who underwent cancer treatment was able to prevail and to get control of the embryos as her last chance for genetic parenthood. So there's both the foundation of the law and then an interesting trend to follow here.
Professor Magnus?
Yeah, so I agree that the fact that the if one of the parties is going to be infertile and this is the only chance for reproduction, that's clearly relevant. And I think courts have always mentioned that, at least in passing. But I actually think the situations for those other recent cases are actually not at all similar. So, for example, in the Dunstan case in Illinois, that was not a case where there was a couple trying to have a child together as there was in the case with Mimi Lee and Stephen Findlay. Rather, that was a woman who wanted to have children, who was facing infertility, had a boyfriend with no expectation on either part that they were going to remain together. And there was actually evidence in emails and so on that there was at least some understanding that she was going to have dispositional control of the embryos, even if that contradicted the documents that were signed at the time. So I think that's a very, very different set of circumstances and not at all a precedent indicating a fundamental shift compared to a case like this, where you've got on the one hand the person, one of the parties saying they don't want to have a child, and then in addition, of course, the strength of the documented agreement, which is usually given, fairly great weight.
And then I imagine, Professor Magnus, that the fact that Ms. Lee and Mr. Findlay were married, as opposed to just dating or a couple or just merely contemplating having a family, probably weighs on this also, that the marital union affects the way the law views the whole thing.
Right. So, and they're not just – they're married. And say in the Dunstan case, it isn't just that they weren't married. They were seeing each other and they were friends, but there wasn't an expectation that they were going to be a permanent union and raise the child together.
Judith Darr, how do the courts view embryos and parentage in terms of one's rights? I mean, there's a lot of political fighting about the rights of a fetus, whether a fetus is a living thing, you know, actively growing into a baby. But in terms of this embryo, which has yet to, you know, attach inside a woman's body and begin to grow and differentiate and turn into a baby, has the law even begun to play in that? That seems like incredibly thorny legal territory.
Indeed, indeed. And in fact, courts have at times discussed the status of the embryo with respect to this particular kind of dispute. One famous discussion about this is that embryos are neither persons nor property, but occupy an interim category deserving of special respect because of their capacity to become human beings. And that was an early case that discussed this status. But in truth, cases like this do accord the embryos, at least in part, some kind of a property status, at least to the extent that what the decision is about is control of their disposition. And so in that way, even though they haven't explicitly deemed them to be property, the property qualities are what's important in cases like this.
What about in terms of one's desire to become a parent and raise children? Professor Magnus alluded to that somewhat. Is there a larger overall sense of how the law views one's right, privilege to become a parent, to build a family?
There is interesting discussion, in the academic sphere, about that, because we know a lot about the reproductive rights, the constitutional rights surrounding reproductive liberty in the natural conception area, where there is just two people who form this close and personal bond. But when you get assistance from physicians and third parties, even such as egg donors and surrogates, the law is less clear about the constitutional right to procreate in this way, and cases like this are going to help harmonize or distinguish natural from assisted conception from a constitutional point of view as we move forward.
Let's get into a few questions and comments from our audience now. 866-733-6786, and be sure to email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Let's begin on the phones now with Lee Sena in Portola Valley. Lee, good morning.
Hi, Lee Sena. Why can he not just be considered a sperm donor and allow her to have children, and he walks away with no parental obligations?
That's actually a very good question, Lisanna. Professor Magnus, why isn't this the same as just a sperm donation?
So the difference is when one obtains a sperm from a sperm donor, there's an agreement in advance about whether or not the person's going to be involved in the raising of the children and custody rights and child support and all those sorts of things. And typically in a sperm donation case, there are no such rights or obligations. In this particular case where there was an expectation that they were going to have children together, this is a married couple. He's not a sperm donor, and he didn't make the free choice to be a sperm donor. She certainly could have done that, and they could have agreed in advance that her right to control of the embryos took precedence, and that was really what his role was, which seems to have been more similar to the situation that happened in Illinois. But that isn't the case here, and so he has a right to say, I don't want to do this.
Is that the sort of point that bolsters his argument in terms of the embryos being destroyed?
Yes, it does. The fact that he didn't have an agreement and an understanding in advance that he was merely a sperm donor is clearly important.
Judith Darr, how much harder does that potentially make Mimi Lee's case?
Well, let's have the audience think about an analogous situation. Let's imagine that before they divorced, that she was actually pregnant and that the embryos were in her body rather than in a laboratory. At that point, I think everybody understands that he couldn't change, that it's the sperm provider couldn't change his status. He couldn't say, well, I no longer want to be a father, or I just want to be considered a sperm donor. So the question is here, since the embryos are not inside her body, are those rights the same? And many people would argue that he has a right now to have greater control over the prospective pregnancy than he would if there was an actual pregnancy. And that's what makes this case so difficult, I think, and confusing.
Yeah, clearly they seem to be different in that in the case where she had already become pregnant, it's really her body and her right to make decisions and medical decisions and not to have procedures done against her wishes clearly takes precedence over everything else. Whereas in the case of the embryos, the two parties are more or less on an equal footing. I want to add one other thing, which is there's been some discussion about the right to reproduce, but I think it's really important to constrain that to be a right to attempt to reproduce, because I think it's worth noting that the probability that she's going, even if she had control of these embryos, that it would actually result in a live birth is actually fairly small. Given her advanced maternal age at the time the embryos were created, there's only about a 10 to 15% chance that this would actually result in a child. So most likely she won't be able to have a child out of these embryos.
And this was even if it was, say, implanted in a surrogate mother?
The age of the uterus is not nearly as important as the age of the eggs. In fact, it wouldn't really matter what the age of the recipient is. It's really the age of the eggs that really, really matters. And in fact, within a couple of years, that would have gone down from 10% to much, much lower. So in some respects, her autonomy and her right to make reproductive decisions was for the most part already exercised when she decided all the way up until she was 41 years old not to have children. And that's a right and a choice that she made. But to a first approximation, by waiting that long, the choice about whether to have biologically related children to her was for the most part already made.
Let me go to a few of our online comments. One listener writes, if the embryos are implanted and result in a child, then the ex-husband will be financially responsible for this child of his marriage for the rest of his life, something that was not part of the divorce agreement. Further, the embryos were produced when the couple was in love and married. Neither precondition exists now. Another listener writes, I thought they agreed to destroy the embryos if they split up. Why would a court not uphold this contract? Judith Darr, what do you make of that?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why the court might not. Of course, they might. But on the negative side, there's testimony that Dr. Lee gave yesterday that I think is going to her capacity at the time that she signed the agreement. She said that she was speed reading it, that she was very distressed about her cancer diagnosis. So it's possible the court could declare the contract to be void because of her lack of capacity, for example. I think the likelihood of that is very low, but it's certainly possible. Also, there are other cases in which the courts have just declared the contract to be void as against public policy that applied in that particular jurisdiction. So there are a number of reasons why, even though we might look at this as a so-called ironclad agreement, that the law might not treat it as such and work the case out in a different way.
Go ahead, Professor Magnus.
So I really want to make sure that the audience understands how important it is to think about the status of those agreements. For the last quarter of a century, roughly, in the ethics community and, to a large extent, the reproductive medicine community have been saying, because we know these sorts of situations arrive, ethically and hopefully legally, the best way to deal with this is in advance, that at the time that you're undergoing IVF, all these eventualities need to be thought through and informed consent forms, therefore acknowledge these possibilities as a standard practice, whether they're legally required or not. If it was the case that this was going to be thrown out and these were found to be non-binding, this actually could be quite serious because it means our whole approach to ethically thinking about these kinds of issues would be thrown out.
Let's continue on the phones now with Rhett in Menlo Park. Rhett, good morning.
Good morning. My question is it possible with current technology to splice out the genetic material of the father and splice in perhaps another sperm donor's, like, you know, mine or someone else's, severing the genetic tie to the father and severing his obligation to the genetic material?
Rhett, that's a really interesting question. Professor Magnus, I'm guessing the answer is no, because once the egg and the sperm combine and go from egg, sperm, zygote, embryo into fetus, they are now one living thing.
Yeah, that's correct. Right now, that is not technically possible. Even the limited amount of gene editing technology we have with CRISPR, that would be far beyond what we could do today.
And even if it was possible, there's all kinds of liability that comes along with monkey around with the genetics of an embryo.
That is correct.
I'd like to add just a little bit about rewinding that technology. Actually, this case is a product of technology, but I think technology ultimately will get us out of these scenarios. Today, the recommendation in many scenarios is to freeze the gametes, not the embryos. Sperm has been effectively frozen and thawed for decades, but only recently have we improved the technology for freezing eggs. So today, a couple like this one, would be encouraged to freeze their gametes separately so that when they do divorce, he can take his sperm, she can take her egg, and there won't be the dispute over the embryo. So I think that's really what's in our future rather than the gene editing opportunity that Dr. Magnus discussed.
I agree with you, but you've always got a challenge where even if there's a relatively modest decline in the fertility rates for frozen oocytes versus embryos, and those have certainly gotten closer, when you've got a patient with advanced maternal age, that even a modest difference could make a huge difference in whether or not it's really feasible to have a child.
So what you're basically saying is that you can freeze the individual gametes, the egg or the sperm, but that the egg's ability to bear a child over time decreases significantly. The sperm maybe has more viability over time, but for the woman, she's not freezing an asset of equal chronological value.
That's correct. And again, at a younger age, that difference might not be as significant. But at 41, where the probability of a successful birth is so small, even a 20 or 30% decrease in success would be very significant.
We're getting a lot of great comments, and we're almost out of time for this segment. Let me get to a few more. Wendy in Berkeley wrote us via email, "My two cents, if you have not personally been through the heart-wrenching process of infertility, there is honestly no way you could understand the emotional complexity of this issue. All I have is compassion for all parties involved in this case." Another listener writes, "These embryos were frozen when both partners were willing. They're now divorced, and one partner is no longer willing. Going forward with fertilization would be morally tantamount to forcing the ex-husband to now have procreative sex with his ex-wife and to assume the role of father with her. In the real world, that would be absurd." Let's continue on the phones now with Neil in Palo Alto. Neil, good morning.
Yeah, your guest started to touch on this. If your guest could comment on what I'll call the the pre-dispute agreements, and in general, whether those are individually negotiated or whether the medical institution is presenting those as sort of form agreements. And if your guests can talk about, you know, just the state of the practice in this case in general and what they think it should be in terms of individual negotiations versus what I'll call form agreements.
Okay, good question, Neil. Judith Darr, can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine, along with other groups, do make available forms. So the caller is right that typically, the couple is presented with a pre-printed form, but there are opportunities for deviating from the choices on the form. And, of course, it's up to the couple to discuss between themselves what they want in terms of their joint disposition. So they are forms, but they're certainly free to negotiate and change to make them more appropriate for their personal decision-making.
Let me get
and they're usually tick boxes that they can sign for different options. One piece of evidence that this was taken at least somewhat seriously is that the typical default that most people do is to have the embryos discarded in the event of divorce or death or any of those kind of circumstances. But in this particular case, there was actually part of the agreement that said that in the event that her husband passed away, she would actually retain dispositional control of the embryos, which is not that common, which does give at least some weight to the idea that that was at least to some extent thought through.
Let me get to a few more emails. Rick in Palo Alto writes, "It seems to me that to take the possibility for this woman to have a child away is the ultimate cruelty. Since this divorced couple has agreed upon all other divorce issues, the court should let this woman have her baby. It is unforgivable and mean-spirited by the man involved." Another listener writes, "Can't she sign away any rights to ask for child support or financial or parental responsibility from him? It seems extremely selfish on his part to deny her the only chance she will have to have her own children. He will have another chance." Judith Darr, is that so? Can she just sign a document that says, "I got this, you don't have to be involved, and I won't ask"?
Probably not. The law doesn't permit adults to anticipatorily waive the rights of children, whether they're born or whether they would be born in the future. So it's not impossible that he wouldn't be deemed a legal father, but it's very unlikely.
And I'd also add that even if the law did allow it, which it apparently doesn't, it's hard to say psychologically, emotionally, and morally for some people, if they know that this is their child, that they shouldn't have any involvement. So they may not want to have that child, but they may feel some sense of duty or obligation towards their child.
Before I let you go, I don't want you to have to call winners and losers here, but I would like to know from both of you, how does this case look like it's trending right now? Who appears to have the stronger case at the moment? Judith Darr?
Well, again, just to go on the trend, and there's been a case that Dr. Magnus talked about, the Illinois case. There's a Pennsylvania case, which facts are identical to this one, in which the court did give the embryos to the woman. So it may be in this case that her particular circumstances would balance the interest in her favor.
My guess is that the fact that there was an agreement in advance that seemed to have governed his decision-making going forward will wind up, in addition to his right not to have a child, will trump, and I would be very surprised if she was allowed to have dispositional control of the embryos.
That's Stanford Professor David Magnus, the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the Stanford School of Medicine. David Magnus, thanks for coming in. And Whittier Law School Professor Judith Darr also teaches at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. Judith Darr, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll shift gears to a groundbreaking study out of UCSF to deeply explore the health issues of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.